Hey, everybody. How's it going? I'm your host, Austin Williams, and you're listening to Relevant Tones. Quick question for you as the listener. What do you know about speculative history? It's been a bit of a phenomenon in music, and little did I know that it would be a topic that comes up in this interview and overview of the composer Neil Quigley. I'm not going to spoil too much, but I will say that I was definitely caught with my pants down in the middle of my chat with him, and I think it's quite funny. I'm going to leave it at that because I think it's a good listen, and you'll hopefully enjoy the surprise that I did as well. Don't really want to go into too much detail about the music we just listened to either, because I think it'll totally give it away. But Neil is a wonderful and prolific composer doing some great projects. We'll hear all about it in the interview. Let's get it going. Here's the interview with Neil.
So I'm Neil Quigley. I'm a composer and I live in Glasgow currently. I sort of live between Glasgow and Kilkenny, which is my hometown in Ireland. I'm actually just back off a little Irish tour, which is really fun.
Yeah.
Which is pretty wild being back during the summer. what else? I compose like mainly at the moment. It varies a bit, but largely what people sort of respond to at the moment is this like speculative history thing that I do, which is like Kilkenny Electroacoustic Research Laboratory Anthology, which is like on a second volume. And I'm doing the like third volume now. But, you know, it always takes longer than you plan when you're writing music in like 15 or 16 different voices, you know.
Thank you for, you know, joining me across the pond here. I discovered, Neil and his music, kind of when I was, doing some work for a previous episode, and I came across, a work by a Chicago composer that I know and have, you know, spoken with before, Sam Scranton, and, his, work with you, on that project. Well, and I think we'll get to that a little bit later, but, as I dive a little deeper though, I discovered you're, you know, very involved with this, anthology of music coming out of the, Kilkenny Electroacoustic Labs. And I just became instantly fascinated. I had no idea, that it existed. And it's a really lovely chunk of, history relating to this, very, I guess, niche or like specific style of music and art creation. So I'm curious, it looks like you're putting together, like you said, you're putting together like anthologies of works that, have been going on there. So you kind of have an archivist role currently.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's fictional, just to make that clear.
Okay.
So like,
oh, okay.
Yeah. So it's like there's a long lineage in the UK, it seems, of like this speculative history ontology thing.
Oh, okay.
Which like, you know, there's Simon Reynolds who writes about it a lot. And there's this guy, I actually forget his name. He made Scarfolk, which is this like fictional little town. That he wrote a book about and sort of, I got like super interested in, during lockdown.
Got it.
At the start of lockdown, and I was like, oh, you could do that for an electroacoustic lab in Kilkenny, which I think would be super interesting. Yeah.
Okay.
Cause Kilkenny is where I grew up and, you know, I don't know where you grew up, but there's a lot of baggage usually where you grew up,
right?
Like politically or economically or whatever. Yeah.
Sure.
Like grew up in a council estate, like a single parent home, that type of thing.
Yeah.
So like during lockdown, going back from living in Chicago, I was super bored over, as everyone was, like this weird, riddled with fear, but also incredibly bored all the time.
Right.
Which is a weird combination. But I started buying like loads of just equipment from Reverb and Adverts, which is like the reverb of Ireland, but there's more like tractors on it, I guess. You know, there's like, so yeah, I bought loads of like old equipment and I just kept like buying and testing out stuff and sort of researching, mastering and mixing techniques from like 60s and 70s. And then I had all these experiments, recording experiments that I didn't really know what to do with.
Yeah.
And then at one stage, I just thought it would be very, I think it was after discovering the Scarfolk, I was like, oh, it'd be funny to do like that, like the design job he did on it, mm-hmm. to make all these like pretty like interesting, historically accurate design work. With this material that I was working on anyway, these little experiments.
Yeah.
And then it just got sort of out of hand and I started writing about it and making all these characters based on people who I knew or grew up with. And it became this sort of like bloated thing after, you know, but like there was nothing else to do during lockdown other than to imagine this world, you know?
Yeah. So just to be clear, this is hilarious. So when I look at on like Bandcamp, the Kilkenny Electroacoustic Research Lab anthology, I look at all these composers. These are fictional composers, or these are people that you kind of made up. Uh-huh. That is, oh well, you fooled me. That's so funny, actually.
This is the problem with the thing, right?
Yeah.
Which is the interesting thing. So part of the influence was this thing that came out, I think it was during lockdown too, where it was like Spotify. Mm-hmm. You would log on to Spotify and then you'd like turn on like slow 70s jazz or something like that. Yeah. And be this playlist of like slow 70s jazz, but then you'd Google any of the people who made it and they just wouldn't exist, you know?
Oh, because it's like AI or some shit like that?
It's either AI or a Swedish guy in his bed, a Swedish 18-year-old in his bedroom who has like really amazing plugins, or, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
And it was just became the thing. And I was like, that's so fun because it caught me out so many times. And then this was like the first volume was supposed to be really, really small and sort of an inside joke. And then there's an Irish language radio producer who said, oh, I'll play along with it. And it was on like Irish language radio, which, you know, isn't. It isn't a bit, and we released it on like April 1st. So like that was a clue that was fictional. And, but yeah, it was interesting that it served the function of that Spotify thing that I was talking about.
Yeah.
like it tricked people, which was really weird to me. Cause I feel like there's enough anomalies, but then like, you know, like on YouTube, there's like, crate diggers and stuff like that who get old music and publish it. They shared some stuff. And then the comments underneath that was like super interesting. You know, it was like these synths are Ableton synths, or, you know what I mean? Like, sort of like super interesting stuff came out of it. And then it sort of like just took off. But it didn't take, it's, you know, it's not Taylor Swift, you know.
Well, and that's what I think is so interesting, because like the example you brought up is like these fictional people writing, you know, I guess like background music or pop music or stuff that's like generally consumed by a larger population, but like doing this for, as I mentioned earlier, a very like niche and like, you know, specific style of like art is really funny, actually. And I don't know if you're trying to have like some commentary on the whole, like, oh, you don't really know the man behind the curtain type deal. But again, you definitely fooled me, and I'm still kicking myself on that. It's too funny.
That's what I like. It's honestly, it's not like I really didn't intend to. I think part of it is like there's so many little Irish jokes in it.
Okay.
And I didn't intend to like write it for anyone outside of like my friend group, you know?
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
So it's like, you know, it's like Sam knew that, Sam Scranton, or like,
yeah,
you know, my Chicago friends like knew I was doing this, and it was like a silly thing that it's like in my personality, whatever.
Yeah.
But it's very funny when people come across it, and you know, it is that sort of, there's an uncanniness to it, you know.
Yeah.
But I think like, yeah, it's like, say with the book, there's a whole like book with the second volume.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
It becomes pretty evident when you start reading parts of it, that it becomes so outlandish, you know?
Okay.
But the funny thing is, like, the outlandish bits are drawn straight from, like, when I was a kid in growing up in Kilkenny, you know, like, from characters and stuff like that. And the non-outlandish bits are pretty banal, you know, that I had to invent. Yeah.
So, no, continue if you got to.
No, I was just saying that it's funny that you only realized now as we were speaking.
I mean, I thought I did my due diligence, you know. I was, you know, and again, I'm not from the area, so I, you know, I don't know maybe some of the jokes that are there. So I honestly think it's wonderful, and I think this is a fantastic bit of you know, research and journalism here. Thank you. No, so okay, so let's dive into that a little bit. So you kind of did this and as a reaction to, you know, these fake artists you're seeing on Spotify, you said you bought a bunch of gear, so like a bunch of like retro stuff to kind of like take a dive into this older aesthetic. And I will say that when I was because we featured one of your pieces, I forget which one, on a previous episode, I commented on it. I'm like, it's really good, but it sounds like of the era. It sounds like dated. So like, you know, good. Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah, I mean, even from a sonic perspective, I was fooled. And I guess my question is like, what you got maybe some of this retro gear, you got some of these like ideas, like who are maybe some of like your inspirations or like your like folks that you were trying to model or like in general, like aesthetically, like trying to kind of go after with some of this stuff?
I suppose the main one, like when I was 20, I got to do the exchange scholarship to Wesleyan. And I took a class with like Alvin Lucier. So he was like a big one. There's just like, there's a ripoff piece of his on the second volume, which is like, but instead of like music for objects, it's like music for 30 something barons, like Irish bone drum.
Yeah. Okay. I see that now. Yeah.
you know, but like, I remember like, in Northwestern, they had like old Alvin Lucier records. Mm hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh shit, I'm going to digitize. I think it was Spherix, the piece Spherix, you know. Mm-hmm. I was like, recordings of the ionosphere. And I was like, oh, I want to digitize this and like put it on YouTube so everyone can listen to it. But like the record was so damaged that I couldn't really tell the difference between the Spherix sounds or the crackle on the record, you know.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So I was like, okay, well, that's not my idea. But that was like an inspiring thing for like the production value of some of these type of things where like, you know, in Ireland at the time, it was probably very difficult to get decent recording equipment. Yeah. And so like, it's an excuse for things to sound bad, but like to make stuff sound convincingly poorly recorded is quite difficult. No, it was actually the biggest struggle with the two volumes so far was actually like doing that, and then like the remastering of that. So like dirtying it up, so it's like it has a sense of verisimilitude, but then doing the remaster on it, and like what does that mean?
You know?
Very real sense. You know? You're like, okay, what am I actually? Actually, I think this speculative history thing is like. Pretty like common in Ireland at the moment.
Yeah.
See, I don't know why I've been talking. Like there's a guy, Frank Sweeney, I want to say his name is.
Okay.
He came over to Glasgow and showed a movie. And it was like the speculative history movie. And we did support. We did some like Enya covers and Clown covers. Yeah. But like in the, we wrote a program, so it was, but we, and we said it was like from this composer, Tony Quinn, who is on the second volume.
Yeah, I see that. Yeah.
He was sort of like an ambient, like a Japanese ambient artist, but, you know, from Ireland, basically. Yeah. And he sort of went and became a recluse in the late 90s, but swears he wrote the music to the Lord of the Rings movies, you know. which we thought, it was like, that's very, you know. Yeah. I think it just adds like an extra layer onto like, or it adds like a conceptual excuse to indulge your sort of guilty pleasures on stage, you know?
Oh, yeah. Like, Well, I think you're like, yeah, man, I think they're like very much subverting the whole typical composer. Like, this is my, like, I'm putting my name on this. This is like my composition, you know, type deal. And really relinquishing that ownership into, you know, an alter ego or a pen name or however you want to put it. But like, I think that's, I mean, that's pretty incredible, honestly. And I would imagine, I think you kind of hinted at earlier, you maybe felt an amount of like artistic freedom in doing that. You know, you didn't feel like you're like, oh, like, as we all do when we write, we can get in our own heads sometimes. But like, if it's going to be under a different name, then all of a sudden maybe you're a bit more free in what you want to create.
Totally. And it also happened. It's the reverse as well, where you sort of feel like, you lack responsibility for it. You don't claim responsibility. Mm, yeah. I mean, suddenly you can write about stuff you're not comfortable with,
yeah,
or dealing with, you know.
Yeah.
But then also the layer of like, when the entire thing is fictional, then you can slip little nuggets of reality into it, which, yeah, like, there's a surprising amount of reality in like the nonsense of the whole thing, you know.
Sure.
There's even a character that's like an imagined version of me from the 60s or 70s. And it's like, you know, they write a fictional type of music from the 50s.
Okay.
And it basically, you know, explains the conceptual elements behind this work, but in the guise of 30 or 40 years behind from a different composer, you know.
Yeah.
But it's nice because, like, no one was like, oh, that's you. You know, people were just like, that's another composer, which is, you know. Yeah. It's nice that you can sort of slip that in a way, you know.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, I always struggled with, like, composer and, like, the individual artist. I was always very uncomfortable with that. And like, towards the end of my time in Chicago, that was something I was really struggling with, like,
yeah,
like a crazy amount, you know. Yeah. I'm like, what even is, like, because I think, like, me and Sam started collaborating, and it was, like, so valuable. And then the idea of like doing stuff by myself seems sort of like, I put my name on anything, or, you know, even like, so I'd release these under my own label.
Yeah.
But with each release, I'd write a letter from management of the label, and it would be signed Neil P. Quigley, who's like a fictional hyper version of myself. He's like a small Irish business owner who's struggling to run this independent label or whatever.
Sure.
So, like, I think, I don't know what it is, but I find it very hard to sort of be like a serious composer and have serious thoughts, you know. I don't know what that is, but
yeah. Totally. I totally agree, or not agree, but like, I understand, because like, I think a lot of people, especially composers, can benefit from an amount of whimsy, you know, in their work, just because you can get inside your own head from like a creation standpoint, and like, oh my God, like, I mean, I recently went through this with my own work, you know. I feel like my aesthetic, you know, has shifted, and I'm like, oh my God, like, does anything I ever wrote like still have validity? And I'm like, well, yeah, duh, of course it does. You know, I was still me that wrote it. So, but it's tough. And like, I really like your way to just kind of maybe compartmentalize it and like cope with that issue. And like, but I think at the end of the day, and I think most people who create art and stuff is like, maybe it doesn't matter so much what the name is on it, but you still get to create it. So that's really all that matters. I'm still kicking myself. This is funny.
That's very good. No, that's, yeah, very funny.
So
it couldn't have gone any better, I don't think.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure the email correspondence, you're like, this guy has no idea. This is hilarious. I'm not.
Thank you.
I always assume people know, but I try and make it as clear as possible. But again, it's like, no, most of the are like very culturally Irish, I guess.
Sure. Well, yeah. And that's okay. And that's the thing is like, maybe that's, I think that's part of the charm here that I'm finding, at least. I'm like, oh my God, there's this whole thing that I'm just like not even aware of. And now it's going to entice me to go even further and learn more about it. So I think you really, I mean, honestly, like this is kind of a, if I dare impose, like, it seems like it's a little bit of a love letter as well to maybe, you know, your hometown and like maybe where you grew up, even though you said there might be some baggage, but if there's that much, like, you know, you're able to joke about it or have this much, I guess, casual, you know, relationship or like play with it, then I think like that's.
Well, I mean, that for me, that was the biggest struggle of it, with the exception of like the master, the technical elements.
Yeah.
The conceptual elements is like that it works, that the music works as what it is or what it claims to be.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way to do that is like testing it out in the field. And also like it doesn't have a pointing the finger at making fun of a thing. Mm-hmm. Like I feel like the Scarfolk thing, Richard Littler, I think is his name.
Yeah.
It's amazing here. But like that does a good job of like pointing fun at small town Britain, but also like, you know, being a love letter to it.
Sure.
And I wanted this to be like a love letter to my experience of Kilkenny and like a sort of articulating to myself what it was like before I was born there. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. And maybe like your perception of what it was like, you know, before you were born there and like what it was like in the like mid to, you know, late 20th century, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Like
the environment I was born into, like imagining what that could have been like or possibilities of what it could be like. Yeah. But then also the contemporary music, it's like, I didn't want to be like, oh, I'm going to do like imagine if like Stockhausen was Irish.
Right. So, you know, yeah.
I really want to go down that road, even though that's in it. But I wanted it to actually, the music to work on its own accord.
Well, there is this like, I need to listen to it more, but I would imagine it's like, yeah, like what if, or what would, because especially with this type, you know, the music concrete and all that stuff, it was so reactionary, right, to the whole, like, the area and the world that it was created in. So I would imagine that was part of your, you know, conceit or, like, beginning of just being like, all right, so if an individual that was interested in this, like, you know, this art was in this area, what would their, you know, sonic reaction be to it, essentially?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like the reality of things back then was like the Catholic Church was like the big arbiter of what was allowed and not allowed.
Yeah.
And shown. So I think that's probably why there's such a big movement of speculative history stuff from Ireland at the moment of like, what if the Catholic Church weren't there? What if? It's interesting. Actually, like so we released two volumes of it, and then there was like a YouTube comment under one of the Tony Quinn tracks, which is like the ambient Japanese thing or whatever.
Yeah.
I was like, oh my God, I love this. I wish I could listen to a whole album of it. And then I was like, yeah, I'm going to need to make a whole record of this for this one guy on YouTube. You know?
I mean, yeah, the sheer plethora of different like writers and composers you've created. I mean, I think you have, you could spend your entire life building this, you know, lore, you know, if you were so inclined,
that's just, why I need to cut it off at volume 3. I'm like, okay,
yeah.
I'm gonna cut it off. I can go like temporarily, I'm cut off. I can go deeper into the 30 years or whatever. But the Tony Quinn record, I was like worried that it was like, oh, it's like it didn't have the function that I wanted, and it was just like wallowing, like, oh, okay. Aren't I so funny? You know, like, mm-hmm. Isn't this so ironic or whatever? Like,
right.
Thing
right.
I had in my head. I was like, so I said, I'm going to start playing this stuff live. And like, people's parents really liked it. And I was like, okay, this is like, and this woman came up, like a friend of mine, and she's like, I went through like chemo last year.
Oh,
and like
wow.
This, she started crying. And then like, I started crying. And it was like all over this like fictional bullshit, you know. it was like, okay, there's something really, the fact that it worked as its own thing really was the thing that was like, okay, this is like valuable doing it. It's not just this self-indulgent sort of me looking back at my own history or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. This is obviously a big project of yours, or maybe you said you're rounding it out here, which is very cool. And you have other projects that you're working on as well. Do you want to briefly maybe touch on that, and maybe like, I don't know, maybe some stark differences, or like how you maybe approach stuff that isn't this like faux historical, phenomenon?
Yeah, I mean, like the faux phenomenon keeps me sort of grounded to like a verisimilitude, you know. So I'm like, because the tour that I just came back on, it was just like it went really well, and people dug the set or whatever. But it's like the set is like it's insane, you know.
Yeah.
I feel like people were just like, "Are you mentally okay?" You know, it's like there's a whole like. There's the whole final section of the set is like this Matrix sequel that I made, where it's me in a call center talking to someone who's struggling. And it's just like, you know, it works in the context of it, but outside of like the thing, it's the same as anyone. It sounds sort of like a crazy thing to put into a contemporary music set.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Like a 10-minute Matrix sequel, you know. But I like it makes sense to me, and it makes sense when you stick when you you know, and like half of, or like there's a 8-minute like sine wave, just intonated sine wave,
yeah,
two sine wave banks, and it lasts for 8 minutes, and there's me on stage just listening. You know, I have my eyes closed, but then there's a projector, and there's like these little interruptions, so it plays on this like dividing the audience in a way into like immersive and non-immersive art, which is like immersive is like a pet peeve of mine at the moment. So it's a sort of about that, where like I'm immersed if you're looking at me listening, and like friends of mine were like, okay, learning from what I was doing, so they closed their eyes and started listening, but they missed this whole layer of the piece as I missed the whole layer of the piece. So like separated the audience into like who was seeing the visuals and had read this thing that was happening.
Yeah.
And then the audience didn't, because they were like, they gave themselves over to the immersion of it, you know?
Yeah.
So like stuff like that, I've been finding super interesting.
Yeah. Back to your, like, you know, the Matrix, like just kind of popping up in your set. Like, I had the lovely chance and had a lovely conversation with, Reiko Futing, last summer, I want to say. Goodness, I think it's been about a year, but you know, he's very involved with like postmodernism and stuff like that. But he was obviously born in like in an earlier era, so his, you know, take on postmodernism is he uses a lot of like older, you know, Renaissance music and stuff like that, because I think that was just more prevalent in his upbringing. But I think it's like totally valid to take a similar approach like that of like, you know, reusing material from like your, you know, experience of just like living. And again, there might be some like irony behind using a very that's an example of using a very popular, like well-known piece of media, but I
suppose it just enables you to talk about stuff way darker than you would otherwise, because it's like ephemeral. Like I read this book recently, it's Goat Man. Do you know this book by Thomas Twaits?
No, it sounds great though.
But he's an artist, and or like a speculative designer from London.
Okay.
I think he's London. And he has the idea of taking a holiday from being human by becoming an elephant, but then over time it changed to a goat. It's a conduit for like really like big ideas that are like super accessible in this like funny book, you know.
Yeah.
And it's like crazy idea of like becoming a goat.
Because I mean, like, you know, escapism exists in so many forms, but that's probably like the most it's like a very absurd way to approach it.
yeah but it's great because it means that it's, I think, someone like I would never read a book about goat biology, but suddenly through this I'm thinking about all this stuff, or like
yeah
it's just a, you know, I think a lot of that, I like thinking of simplifying certain aspects of a work to make certain other aspects more articulated.
Yeah,
you know, making something like seem stupid, making a thing seem stupid, and then like under the guise of that have something like meaningful or whatever.
Yeah, and it kind of slaps you in the face when you might realize, you're like, oh shit, like, okay, this was actually, you know, about this, or, you know, That sounds like you're doing great stuff, man. I'm excited to, it looks like your project you're doing with Sam is releasing stuff here and there, and everything I've been hearing from it is lovely.
It's such a class to do it. You know, I mean, it's that was one thing that at one of our lectures, me and Sam's lecture in Northwestern was Ryan Dehoney. He writes a lot about friendship and music, I guess.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's like, you know, the reason for doing stuff with a lot of, like, me and Sam do stuff. Me, Sam, you know, Bryn Davis and Nick Merrihu.
I know Nick. Yeah.
We do stuff together. And it's like, you know, music was just a way of keeping in contact with these people over the last 5 or 6 years since leaving Chicago. And it's like, yeah, it's sort of amazing to be like, to have a final body of work.
Yeah.
And, oh, we did something remotely together, you know.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Well, awesome, man. Well, if there's, is there anything else you want to talk about that we haven't touched on, or you want to throw into the universe?
No, I mean, like, you know how it is. There's a ton of, I have a ton of stuff going on. Like, I have this, like, network music group in Glasgow. That's a whole different thing.
Sure.
But, yeah, there's just, like, you know how it is as a freelance person.
Oh, yeah. Sort of, everything and everything and nothing at the same time. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Bouts of, like, fear and then boredom and then fear again.
Yeah. Such a lovely lifestyle to pursue.
I hear it's very, very healthy too.
Yeah, exactly. Hey folks, we're back. I thought that was hilarious that I was fully under the impression that this was a real thing. And it's not that it's not a real thing, because Neil wrote this music, he created this lore, he created these characters, this whole idea of speculative history, and it is kind of this response to, as he mentioned in the interview, that composer he found out was actually just some kid writing music in that aesthetic. And as we mentioned, I think it's just lovely that he made this love letter and this you know, faux history of, like, well, what if there was an electroacoustic lab in this part of my, you know, hometown or this part of Ireland during that time? What would the music sound like, and how would people be writing it, and what would they be writing about? And now that I know that there's some little pokes and jabs in there with humor, I went back and kind of listened to it and looked at some of the titles, and yes, that's actually quite whimsical and quippy, you know, and in the way it's presented. So congrats to Neil. Beyond that, I mean, I guess look out for the third volume that's going to be coming out, because I think that's awesome that there's one more. But I also agree and totally understand why he's probably putting a kibosh on it after that, at least for now, because that is, you know, that could just turn into a lifelong project. But check out some of his other stuff. We're sending you out with a tune that we featured on the show before, Wunderbaum, by the band Physique. I do really enjoy this track. I think it's a good ending track, so maybe we'll just leave it there for now. This is your reminder that Relevant Tones is a product of Access Contemporary Music. Find out more at acmusic.org, and we'll catch you all next time. Thanks, folks.